from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of some local fall art specials produced by our sister station, TV20.
I'll find out about a new literary map of Indiana and the Indiana Center for the Book.
And I'll get a sneak peek at the first half of the Phoenix Theater's new season, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. We know that sometimes you like to see the pictures while hearing about Central Indiana arts events. So Sharon Gamble invited WFYI's Vice President of Production Clayton Taylor and producer Gary Harrison to give us a sneak peek of some of TV20's local fall arts specials.
All right, so September is arts kickoff month, especially on TV20. This is a tradition that's been going on for a while, right, Clayton?
Yes, we have been very active in a lot of arts productions for a number of years, and so we like to do our part to help kick off the arts season, and this year we've been able to develop a number of programs that will be targeted for release in September, mm-hmm. That really celebrate some of the city's biggest arts events during the course of the year.
Right, right. I know I'm often at events where I run into various WFYI personnel who are there. Oh, we're shooting this. Well, cool. What's that going to end up? What special will that end up being? Gary, I know you have shepherded. You probably know how many thousands of hours of video for Fireworks, the 2014 International Violin Competition special. How many hours did you?
Not in the thousands, might be in the hundreds,
okay.
But I can tell
Felt
you
like
it was 12 terabytes of
footage.
Oh,
my gosh.
Whatever that translates to.
Oh, my gosh. And this partnership with the International Violin Competition has been going on for three or four competitions, hasn't it?
I believe so. Clayton, you know that?
Does that sound
yeah,
right?
I think this this has to be at least our third.
Yeah.
And because it's every 4 years, I have to do the math. But I think
right.
It's the third one that we've done with them. But I know there is even a fourth one we had been involved with, at least as sort of a Dutch uncle to help it get off the ground.
Right, right. So when tell us about, you know, our listeners are going to turn on TV20 and they're going to see this beautifully polished, fabulous final program. But tell us a little bit about behind the scenes, where you start as a producer and what are your guiding principles?
Well, you start with what's going to happen. And with this particular event that took up most of the month of September in 2014,
mm-hmm.
you had arrival of your contestants, your violinists at the airport. You want to capture that. There's a ceremony for picking the numbers, who's going to go in what order.
Mm-hmm.
You want to capture that. There's a gala opening ceremony that took place at the Indiana Roof Ballroom. You want to capture that. And when you say you want to capture that, it's not just with one camera. It's not just with two cameras. It's three or four or five cameras. Then you go into the competition, and the competition is first round is 4 days, second round is 4 days, and third round, the final round, is divided into two-day situations, and those are all multi-cameras. And then if that's not enough, you're also going mm-hmm. out and visiting the contestants, the violinists, at their host family homes to get little profiles of the violinists and of the host family so that you can kind of show the human side of these people who are standing up there playing their hearts out on stage one after another for about 20 days.
Yeah. And you have a lot of challenges, opportunities, depending on how you want to frame it, because you're visiting so many different venues, and especially when you're shooting the music, different acoustics. How do you navigate all that?
Well, we're really lucky. We have Cedric Freeman, who works here at WFYI, and he is a master of recording this kind of music, orchestral music. classical musical instrument music. And so he was in charge of that and, as always, did a magnificent job. I didn't have to think about that.
Oh, well, yay. Delegation is a fine thing. But then you also have your producers, your videographers who are producers and videographers, I should say, because they're not the same. Hey, we should define those terms. What do those mean?
Videographer is the guy or the lady with the camera in their hands, mm-hmm. looking through the eyepiece and capturing the images and the sound. What was the other one?
Producer.
It's just kind of a traffic cop, keeps things moving forward toward the finish line.
But somebody is also thinking not just about the B-roll, just the, you know, the run-of-the-mill stuff, but somebody's also gathering intelligence on the ground and saying, we can't visit the host, we can't visit 30 participants of the violin competition all in their host family's homes. We can only visit, say, 8, and somebody has to figure out which 8 will be the best stories. How do you do that?
Well, that's a tough one. It's always great if you've been out to visit with the person who eventually wins the contest. And so
you have a crystal ball.
Yeah,
awesome.
And you know, you need better antenna for violin talent than I have. Uh-huh. Fortunately, there was some around that guided us in some vague but in the end correct directions so that we got to the right people. There are also, you know, you observe along the way. You introduce yourself, you do interviews, and you see who's animated. You see who might have a story. And another neat thing is before this competition began, we received quite a few questionnaires from the contestants, just to give us some idea of who they were, their interests besides the violin, et cetera, et cetera. And so that helped us out a lot, too.
And then you're also, I'm sure, doing a little bit of balancing of just what the visual is. Somebody on the lower end of the age spectrum, the upper end of the age spectrum.
You want it all.
Yeah.
If you're just 16 and getting started in these competitions, it's a lot different ballgame than if you're 28 and you've only got 2 years to go and then you're done with these competitions.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, as we're having this conversation, I have to ask because I know there's so much work that goes into this and people may be saying, wait, that was last year. But yeah, it takes a year to put a good documentary together. Is it done? You still polishing?
Still polishing. We'll polish for a couple more weeks and then I will hand it over to my partner in crime, Dave Tarr, editor extraordinaire, who will make it beautiful.
Favorite moment from this documentary so far?
Favorite moment. You know, the favorite moment for me is the fact that during the competition, all I did is run around and say, who's doing what? Who's shooting what? This, that. Oh, we don't want to forget to do this. We don't want to forget to do that. And now I'm in the editing room, and I'm watching and listening to the footage, and there was some beautiful music that went on.
Oh, and now you have a chance to
enjoy it. Yes, finally I get to listen to the music, and it's magnificent.
Wow. Can't wait to see it. Can't wait to see it. But as Monty Python would say, and now for something completely different, we've had the partnership with Butler to do something for their Arts Fest.
This is our second year
now
to do that with the Butler Arts Fest. And similarly, what's fun about some of the productions that we do is where we do allow ourselves to become embedded in an ongoing arts activity for a number of days.
What's that look like?
It happens in different ways. For the violin competition, we had crews that were in charge of doing live video webcasting plus live radio coverage every single moment, I think, of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
When also just at the very same time, the different crews are telling all of the backstories for the documentary. For a production like the Butler Arts Fest, we set up a makeshift control room at the Schrott Center for Performing Arts at Butler University, and we're able to keep it in place over about a 9 or 10 day period. Not there for every single performance in this case, but strategically we worked out a vision of what provides a great degree of variety in the types of performances that we're going to be getting. What shows the depth of the celebrities? What's maybe a little bit more avant-garde? What showcases the Butler students in a good way? Because they put on some spectacular productions along the way. And so so we have crews in place that do some behind the scenes shooting while we do this, but really we're setting ourselves up to do as solid a production documentation as possible of multi cameras in the auditorium itself, and so from that we are able to create a 1 hour highlight show that will be broadcast in September. But we also have created for the web a series of probably, I think it's 10 full-length performances of sometimes ranging from an hour to 2 hours or more in length, where the performances can be enjoyed in their entirety on the web.
Instead of just the sampling that we're likely to see when we see the regular special. The theme this year, by the way, was Outlaws and Outsiders, which was a lot of fun. And I imagine with that regular control room that's just sort of there, it disappears from the viewpoint of the performers.
Oh, it does, yes. We moved this year. Last year, we were at sort of the back of the house in where there is the the audio and lights and that type of thing. And I think just because not everything's so completely soundproofed, in order to make sure that the director could talk to the camera people and not have to speak in like a golf hushed tone, which is harder to hear for the camera people when they're out in the middle of the auditorium, that it was some really nice space that was I think largely a kind of a makeshift storage area before we moved in, but it was very soundproof. It actually worked great for our purposes.
It's now called the WFYI room at Schrott Center, I hope.
I would think, with the right donation, there could be a naming opportunity
there you go.
along the way. But it is a place that I loved visiting just as the executive producer, and I have the luxury of kind of popping in and out of different productions while we have other staff that's responsible for seeing it through operationally each day.
Right.
And we got this year for what is going to be in the show, among the many many performances, we have Angela Brown performing a piece from Aida. I guess that's probably the outsider if it's of Outlaws and Outsiders. Christian McBride Trio was just spectacular. Now, I don't think in either case they were outlaws or outsiders, but they sure were good. And then the Lula Washington Dance Theater did some wonderful numbers, and we're going to be picking one of the performances of a dance routine called "We Wore a Mask." And then there's even the contemporary a pole dancing company called Jagged that mixes a pole dancing with kind of a Cirque du Soleil type of performance, and it really is. It's quite
very
quite
athletic.
Spectacular.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And then we get the treat of closing out September with the APA's jazz competition, right?
Yes, yes. Once again, and that did also involve Christian McBride. We had done in April when the APA actually had the competition at the Hilbert Circle Theater. We did that as a live webcast, video webcast at that point. And it's hosted by Christian McBride and Jill Dittmeyer. And then you have five of the most talented young jazz pianists in the country who were competing. So we've consolidated that evening of the finals into what will be a 2 hour special that will be broadcast in September. I should probably say for all of these, probably going to WFYI.org will be the easiest way to find all of the air dates for these productions. But you had there sublime performances. Each of them performing with Diana Reeves, who is a spectacular jazz vocalist, as well as the Buscelli Wallerob Jazz Orchestra. And so, so even for folks who are not hardcore jazz aficionados, it's it's just a wonderful evening of virtuoso jazz performances, but in a very accessible and intimate type of way. And even the way the Hilbert Circle Theater was created for that evening, they created it with a dance floor, so it had more of a cabaret feel in this otherwise very large auditorium.
Sharon Gamble with Vice President of Production and Executive Producer Clayton Taylor and Producer Gary Harrison. You can see the local fall art shows you heard about at several times on our sister station, TV20. Visit WFYI.org to see the whole schedule.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Suzanne Walker is the director of the Indiana Center for the Book, which is part of the Indiana State Library. The center promotes reading, writing, literacy, libraries, and, of course, books. Travis DiNicola sat down with Suzanne to learn more about some of their current projects.
Suzanne, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Hi, Travis.
Glad you are here. Looking forward to this conversation because you guys are doing some really neat stuff through the Indiana Center for the Book, which is part of the Indiana State Library, which is one of my absolute favorite buildings in the state. You know, before we even get into all the Center for the Book stuff, the State Library has got to be, I mean, it's just such an incredible building inside. And it's one of those buildings I think a lot of people aren't even aware that it's right downtown.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're not talking about Central Library.
No.
That's not the public library, which is a great building, too. We're talking about the State Library.
Yeah, so we often get confused for being Central Library, which I love Central Library too. Mm-hmm. It's great. So the State Library is considered to be on the government campus. So we're really across the street. We're across Senate from the courthouse, from the State House.
Yeah.
And we're connected by a tunnel, which is fun for us. We do a lot of things with them with field trips.
Mm-hmm.
And our building is beautiful. It was built in 1934, and it's an Art Deco style, and it's a wonderful place to come visit. We have a great hall that's got stained glass windows. We have original stacks where all the books were, and we still have books there. We have an enormous card catalog, which I don't
physical
actually,
card catalog.
Yeah, we
actual
have the
like
catalog.
Wooden shelves or
the
drawers.
Wooden drawers
with the,
yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's even still in use. Mm-hmm. So,
well, one of the coolest things is in sort of the main hall. There's just these beautiful light fixtures, these chandeliers that when you first look at them, you're not quite sure what they are. They look very Art Deco, and then you realize that they're actually supposed to be sort of the tops of corn stalks that are and they're enormous and gorgeous. And
absolutely,
it's such a stunning building, and definitely worth a trip just to, you know, pop your head and like, oh, this is a really cool space downtown.
And everything about the architecture and the artwork has to do with Indiana and when Indiana became a state, and so it's a great historical, you know, fun thing to do.
And the library's main purpose is to be first and foremost, sort of a resource about Indiana information, whether it's for the legislators or the public, right?
That's correct, yeah. We actually have two kind of big jobs. The first job is really to serve the public, and to also serve state government.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also support public libraries in Indiana. So that's the other hat that we wear.
Cool.
And then we also have Indiana Center for the Book.
Right. So tell me about Indiana Center for the Book.
Okay. So Indiana Center.
Because this is where all the fun stuff
is. I know,
takes place,
yeah.
Right?
So people always ask me, well, is it a center? Can I come visit? Well, sure, you can come to the State Library, but you're not actually going to see a center, and there isn't like a book there. So Centers for the Books were established in 1977 by the Library of Congress. That's when the Library of Congress, and, you know, the one in Washington.
The big one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they first started their Center for the Book. And then later, in 1984 is when they started centers in all the states.
Okay.
So the Indiana Center for the Book now is housed in the Indiana State Library, and essentially we're kind of a programming entity. So we do all kinds of programs that help promote literacy in Indiana, really literary pursuits in Indiana. So we have a lot of
reading, writing, books, libraries, all that good stuff.
And we do a lot of things for kids. I do a contest once a year called Letters About Literature, which is for grades 4 through 12, and it's where kids write a letter to an author, living or deceased, and the winner for that gets to go on to the competition in Washington, which is pretty great. We also do a State Book Award, the Indiana Early Literacy Firefly Award, which is for promoting early literacy for children. It's all about promoting talking, singing, reading, writing, and playing with kids ages 0 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have Bicentennial. Did you know that the state is turning 200?
Yeah, pretty soon.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a lot of Bicentennial initiatives that we're working on, too.
Very cool. So let's talk about some specific things that are coming up that I think are pretty exciting. And first and foremost is the literary map of Indiana. And I know that you've been working on this for now, it's going on about 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. And I have been involved with it myself. And Indie Reads and Indie Reads Books has been a part of it, as well as a lot of authors and other literary types of organizations, because we have not really had a literary map of Indiana in many, many years. There have been them. They've existed before, but not lately.
Right. So we had one in 1956 was the first one that I could find. Mm-hmm. And then we had another one in 1974. And they were published by the Indiana Association for Teachers of English, I believe is the organization. And so their parent organization is the National Council for Teachers of English, I believe. So on their website, they actually have the 1956 map still there.
Oh, cool.
And they have other links to other literary maps. So that's still there.
But 56 and 74, a few things have happened since then. So
John Green, you know, other things. So, so we really felt like with the bicentennial of our state, that was a perfect time to kind of look at it again and see what, you know, who should we keep on, who should we add. And with the bicentennial, we decided to focus on 200 writers.
Excellent.
Yes, and that was more than was on the 1974 map.
And being a map, so it's a map of the state, and it's really sort of focused on which different counties authors are from. So it's not like their home address, so you can go stalk them or anything like that.
Right. Okay. Absolutely not. Please don't use it to do any sort of travel, because it's not going to get you very far.
Right. It's not that sort of type of map, but it does really highlight, you know, great Indiana authors, both from the past and present.
Yes.
And where they're from, what cities they're from, what counties they're from, and all types of authors. Tell me a bit more about this.
Sure, yeah. So the map itself, when we finally get them, they're at the press right now. So hopefully very soon they'll be available. And we're going to be sending them out to every public library in Indiana. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested, go to your local public library, and hopefully they will have a stash there, and you'll be able to take a look at it. They will be available for free as well. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to have some sort of a form on our website that you can fill out if you would like one. So the map itself is
And we'll have them at Indie Reads Books.
Great. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's 24 inches by 18 inches. It's a poster suitable for framing. It'll go on your wall. And it's got 200 writers on it. And they're in, I believe we ended up with 6 different genres. So mm-hmm. we have poetry, fiction, nonfiction, children's literature, YA literature. And then we also ended up having 4 screenwriters on mm-hmm. there. And let me tell you, there was so many debates about who should be on the map, you know?
Well, it was a great panel of many different writers of different types. And but, yes, I'm aware of some of those debates about
so
you know, who to make partners, sure that we include.
Mm-hmm. Right. So some of our partners were the Indiana Writers Center, mm-hmm. Indiana Humanities, Indie Reads. I should mention, of course, that it's being funded by the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award, mm-hmm. Which is a program of the Indianapolis Public Library. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we also have support from Indie Reads, which is great. So we had all these partners sitting at the table, and we had to figure out how do we pick 200.
Right. You know? Not an easy task.
No, not at all. So we had lots of debates about, like, well, what does literary mean? Mm-hmm. And are songwriters included in that? And what about cartoonists? And all these big questions, you know? And I'm the first to admit that, you know, as soon as this comes out, I'm going to be nervous that someone's going to call me and say, you left Kurt Vonnegut off the map. Kurt Vonnegut is
He's on the map,
definitely. Mm-hmm. But I do live in fear that there's someone major that we missed.
Well, you know, one thing that I found really interesting in the process was looking back at the old maps mm-hmm. and seeing what they had deemed at those times who was an important author to make sure was included. And in many cases, authors who, of course, are going to be on the maps now as well. But there are also a number of authors that, you know, we just haven't heard of anymore since.
Right.
And maybe they were kind of important, you know, 50, 60 years ago.
Right.
But, you know, in some cases, then in some of the research, like, you know what, this is still an important person. Or in other cases, maybe we need to put something else.
So we really wanted the map to be a good, strong cross-section of the entire state. So mm-hmm. you alluded to this earlier. This is one of the things that we looked at a lot was counties and trying to find people in every county. And I'll tell you, you know, we did not find someone for every county. But I also did a population analysis, mm-hmm. which was really fun for me to do because I'm a librarian and I like statistics. But, you know, so when you look at 200 writers, 1% would be two riders. So mm-hmm. if your county had 1% of the population of Indiana, then you're entitled to have two riders. Some, like in South Bend, for example, in St. Joseph County, they have 4% of the population, so they're supposed to have 8 riders. They ended up having 9. You know, and the reason why is because they're kind of a magnet, because mm-hmm. they have colleges and universities mm-hmm. there, exactly. So that was another really interesting thing that came out, was kind of seeing where these hotbeds of mm-hmm. literary performance were happening, you know.
And certainly Marion County.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Marion County was like, it was very competitive. Mm-hmm. If you're on the map and you're from Marion County, then you did a really good job. And I know that there's lots of people from Marion County that we weren't able to put on the map.
Well, one thing, though, that really did impress me, Suzanne, is that how fair the process was in terms of both your research and how you went about it, but also the whole committee, too. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, there really was a sense of wanting to try to be as fair as possible to the writers, to the counties, to the history, to current trends, to past trends. I mean, all that was taken into consideration.
Absolutely. And it was difficult to think of things like, well, for example, Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely has a history in Indiana, but he's not on the map. You know, we decided that political writings weren't necessarily going to count for literary. And some people were like, oh, I'm not sure about that. And other people were like, no, get Abraham Lincoln off. He can be on his own map. You know, and
right.
people felt that
people
same
can
way.
Find him anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, who doesn't know about Abraham Lincoln?
But on the other hand, you may have an author like Rex Stout, who is one of my absolute favorite mystery writers, who wrote all the Nero Wolfe books, who was born in Zionsville. Mm-hmm. And that may be something that a lot of people, you know, will pick up the map and be like, hey, I had no idea that Rex Stout was from Indiana.
Absolutely. And that's another kind of point of trying to make sure that all the big names are on there.
Mm-hmm.
People like Madeline Pugh,
mm-hmm.
she wrote for I Love Lucy for years, and people might not know that she's from Indiana. So it was really, really neat to be able to unearth all these writers. And I actually read a lot, too, just over the course of doing it. I would find these authors, and I'd pick up their books and read their books. And one of the most amazing experiences I had was actually reading Raintree County for the first time. And I feel kind of guilty that I didn't even know about Raintree County a couple of years ago. And come to find out, it's this huge epic novel set in Indiana, you know, by an Indiana author who had a tragic, you know, ending, took his own life like 2 months after the book was published. And so being introduced to Ross Lockridge Jr. And that whole story was just really amazing for me.
That's
great. And I didn't, it's so long. It's like an 800-page book. It might even be 1,000 pages depending on, you know, the publication. And I listened to it, and it was so great. It was just a lovely experience to do that. So doing the map really just educated me a lot more on all the things.
And that's what we hope it's going to do for people who pick the map up and you know, look at it and be like, oh, that's so cool. Or here's a part of history from Indiana I didn't know. Or here's an author I'd like to explore.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. So, I mean, a very, very cool process. It's great to have this map updated for the bicentennial. Before we wrap things up, what else is going on at the Center for the Book that you want to share with us?
So the other big thing that we have for the bicentennial is we have a essay contest every year for Indiana Statehood Day, and it's specifically for fourth graders. So if you've got a fourth grader in your home and they're excited about history, they don't even have to be excited about history. They can be excited about writing, or they can be excited about birthdays. Because the theme for this year's contest is Hoosier Bicentennial Celebrations.
Okay.
And we're just asking the question, how are you going to celebrate the bicentennial? And all the you know, the rules and regulations are on our website, but we would love to get a lot of entries from fourth graders this year for the Statehood Day essay contest.
Excellent.
And then the winners for that get to read their essays on Statehood Day at the State House, at the Indiana State Library, at the Indiana State Museum, and at the Indiana Historical Society.
Travis DiNicola with Suzanne Walker, director of the Indiana State Library's Indiana Center for the Book. For more information, visit in.gov/library/icb.htm. I'm going to give that to you again. in.gov/library/icb.htm. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
So this is the weekend when we officially recognize all the hard work that we as Americans do all year.
Is that what this is? It's not about mothers going into birth?
I hope not.
No, okay. I always get confused.
If you're an expectant mother, don't get nervous. And in fact, if you're just a regular listener and not expecting a baby, don't get nervous either, because we have lots of things that will not require any work on your part on our calendar that we call What Do We Do?
That's right. Artists are hard at work.
That's right.
Musicians especially, because the 19th annual Labor Day Street Fair, barbecue bands, and B-side garage sale and more is all taking place outdoors at a block party in front of the Jazz Kitchen up on 54th and College. Yats and the Jazz Kitchen will be providing food and drink and live music all afternoon. Wendy Reed starting at 2 o'clock, Pavel and Direct Contact at 4, and Rob Dixon and Trilogy starting at 6. The entertainment is free. The food and drink are not, but it will be a great day from 2 to 7:30 at the Jazz Kitchen on Labor Day. I think that's a great way to celebrate Labor Day.
I do indeed. Well, I think there might be just a few tickets left for Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs at the Cabaret at the Columbia
Club. That's going to be a fun show.
I know, indeed. And that's coming up both Saturday, September 12th, two shows that day, and Sunday, September 13th, two shows that day on Saturday, which I think is sold out, but just in case, 7 and 9:30 p.m., Sunday, 2 p.m. and 7 p.m. So if you're like, wait, 2 p.m. at the Columbia Club? Wait, that's not right. How can I listen to jazz during the day? Well, they're going to have a festive brunch menu available for you. And, man, Alan Cumming, what an entertainer. And it doesn't really matter what he's going to do. If the fact that he's here means you should think about going to see him. Cabaret at the Columbia Club. Alan Cumming next weekend. That's the 12th and the 13th.
So Indiana Landmarks has a very cool event coming up. If you're looking for a little road trip that involves some historic building, art, music, wine, food, it sounds good to me. It's the Wine Down, I like that, Wine Down on the Farm at the Huddleston Farmhouse on September 18th. And this event with Indiana Landmarks is in partnership with the Richmond Art Museum. And they've got plein air painters from the Indiana Plein Air Painter Association, the Richmond Art Group. And those will be on display. And Chef Jen Farrell's menu is going to have some great Hoosier food on there, as well as Wilson Winery. And this is all taking place at the Huddleston Farmhouse, which was built in 1841 and is a National Road Heritage Site. So it sounds like a really neat mix of a whole bunch of different things coming together at Wine Down on the Farm from 6 to 9 on Friday, September 18th. If you'd like to get more information, visit indianalandmarks.org, because you will have to make a reservation. Again, indianalandmarks.org. You can also get information on Eventbrite at Wine Down 2015.
Fantastic. Good way to shift gears and start thinking about fall. Hey, if you're saying, oh, I'm kind of envious of all my kids. They're going back to school and they're learning new things, and I want to learn something. How about learning improv? Levels 1 through 4 of improv currently being offered for the fall from September through October. Some classes have started already, but some have not. And where, you might ask? At Comedy Sports Indianapolis down on Mass Ave. And these classes are not just for the aspiring stand-up comedian. These can help you with just about anything you do. If you do public presentations or run meetings, these skills will help you. You can find out
more.
You
need to talk your way out of a parking ticket, maybe?
I'm not sure we can promise that, but hey. If you go to CSZIndianapolis.com, CSZ, which is short for comedy sports, CSZIndianapolis.com, you can find out more and also find out more about the regular shows that go on at Comedy Sports.
Very cool. Hey, Sharon, next week, in addition to our regular show, we're going to be doing a special Penrod preview broadcast, and that's going to run on Friday afternoon. And
1 o'clock.
Yes, which will be very good. So looking forward to that. I just got to interview Aaron O'Rourke from the Irish Fest, which is one of the pieces I'm going to include on our Penrod broadcast. But and you can listen to that next week, but I do want to say I'm very excited about this.
Yeah.
Because the band Off Kilter, which for many years was the popular headliner at Irish Fest and hasn't played at Irish Fest in almost 10 years,
is coming back.
And so the Irish Fest 20th anniversary event, Off-Kilter is going to be playing all weekend long, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday. The schedule is online at IndieIrishFest.com at their website. You can check that out. But if you've never heard Off-Kilter, I think they are the most fun live Irish band I've ever seen. Three guys who they played down at Epcot in Florida for years. They were the Irish band down there, sort of Irish rock and just absolute entertaining music and great guys. And can't wait to see them.
You're going to want some beer.
Oh, yeah. I know they have a lot of fans in town, so people will be excited to be able to get to see Off-Kilter again. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you're going to the Penrod Arts Fair, I had a nice conversation with Stephanie Perry from their public relations and communications department, and she is going to give you some tips on things to do on the IMA grounds in addition to visiting all the artists who are showing and selling at Penrod.
Very cool.
Yeah, so great things coming up. Speaking of things coming up, the re-release of Dan Wakefield's novel Under the Apple Tree is coming up. There's a special celebration on September 16th. That's a Wednesday from 5:30 to 7 o'clock at Indy Reads Books. And, of course, he will be there and reading and talking. And he's so down-to-earth. He's just such a sweetheart. He's one of my favorite famous people who who lived away on both coasts and came back to the heartland.
Yeah.
Bless his heart.
Yeah. Sophie Fott's going to be playing some of Dan's favorite music, and there'll be cider of different sorts for Under the Apple Tree. It's going to be a great event.
Oh, I get it. Under the Apple Tree cider. Uh-huh. Clever.
Nice. Hey, Sharon, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next week on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do? Happy Labor Day.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
This year, the Phoenix Theater is cultivating a mysterious image. Really, because their creative team has chosen a season of mysteries and thrills. So, Sharon Gamble talked with Phoenix producing director Brian Fonseca and playwright in residence Tom Horan about the first half of their year.
How many seasons is this for the Phoenix, Brian?
We're starting our 33rd season.
That seems like it should be a lucky number.
I hope so. Knock on wood.
And you've been here for every single one of them as one of the founders?
I have, from the very beginning. And as well as many of our originating artists who are still working with us regularly, Chuck Goad, Deb Sargent, Gail Steigerwald, and many, many more.
When you started out 33 years ago, did you ever think, I wonder if this is what I'll be doing when I'm a grown-up?
Oh, no. We were just having fun thinking about, and what's the next play we should do? And what, are there parts for us in it? I'm sure that's what the artists were thinking.
Here's what I want to write. Here's what I want to direct. Here's that's what I want to light design. And three must be the lucky number. Tom, you're on your third season as playwright in residence. How did that come about? Remind us.
Me and Brian met through NNPN, and we applied for a grant together, and it was sort of an artistic blind date.
Aww.
Absolutely. I mean, he just contacted me and said, hey, what do you think about this idea? And I'm like, well, we always wanted to have a playwright in residence. Mm-hmm. Here's what the kind of things we do are, and what kind of things do you do, and where do we think we, how would we work together? What would that intersection be?
And remind us what NNPN is.
It is the National New Play Network, and it is theaters like the Phoenix who are focusing on new plays.
So one of the things, if you're above a certain age, you realize is a good thing in a date is how you're different from them. When you had first impressions, Tom, you of the Phoenix, Brian, the Phoenix of Tom, where did you think, we're going to stretch each other's boundaries?
That's a great question. I think the most, my first reaction was after it was announced that we actually received the grant is, ooh, now I wonder how this really will work out. You know, we talked about it, and now we get to meet that person, and, you know, we had some general ideas. And the truth of any grant like that is you kind of do spend an entire season getting to know one another. So it wasn't really, other than the Christmas show, it wasn't really until the second year having Tom in residence that we actually started producing his work. I mean, we made the commitment in the first year to do Typhoid Mary, which turned out to be a great success, and do some readings and talk about projects that we might work on together. But it really wasn't until the second year that we were actually, like, in the groove together. Mm-hmm.
And you're not from the Midwest. Do I remember that?
I have some connections. I went to my undergrad in Chicago.
Okay.
But Indianapolis has been new to me, which is I've got to bring a little bit of outside perspective, got to meet everyone sort of new again, and meet some of these wonderful actors and performers and designers and directors that are part of the community, and try to bring out their strengths as they try to bring out mine.
So one of the things people are like, so what does a playwright residence do? People may be picturing you just sitting at a laptop all day long writing at the Phoenix Theater. I'm guessing you're doing some of that, but you've had a range of gigs. You recently wrote a script for an event that's coming up honoring one of the Phoenix donors and board members, right?
So some of what being a playwright in residence has come to mean is that I've pitched some projects to Brian and said these are some things that I'm very interested in, and it also means Brian has pitched some things to me. And one of them is Phoenix honors Steve Russell, and Brian says told me he had a donor, a supporter of the theater who's been very important to them, and what we decided to do is write a play sort of depicting his life.
How did you figure out how to frame that? Because our listeners, if they remember our past conversation, know that you don't like just a straight chronological sort of structure.
For me, it takes place in a few snapshots of his life because it's so difficult to take on depicting someone's life on stage. What does that mean? So I'm trying to
build. And then he did this, and then he did that, right?
So I want some very strong dots that people can connect the lines between.
But the research included a lot of interviews with family members, with fellow workers, employees, fellow board members, friends. It's been an interesting process. I got to listen to the actual interview with Steve and Livia and found out lots of fascinating information. I mean, we chose the right person to inaugurate this new way of honoring people in the community for us because he's just a fascinating businessman, philanthropist, and human being. I mean, he really is a mentor to me. I just love his joy of life and everything that he's done. And he's impacted so many arts groups here in Indianapolis.
And he's not from here. He's from New York.
Right?
So it's especially interesting to see someone
moved here for love.
Moved here for love. That's right. And kind of started Celadon, the big company,
right,
on a challenge at a toll booth, if I...
You've heard this story.
I have heard that story.
It's going to be in the play.
So that's fascinating right there. And that event is coming up?
On September 19th at the Beautiful Grounds at the IMA. Tickets are still for sale. If you'd like to get information, call us direct at 635-2381, 635-7529, or check online phoenixtheater.org. We'd love to have you join us and help celebrate the life of Steve Russell.
Fabulous. And right after that, like a hiccup later, you start the new season, which is a season of mystery. Tom, were you part of zeroing in on this idea of a season about mysteries? And
I definitely do my best to help Brian navigate the very, very tricky process of selecting a season. And we had a few that we were both sort of drawn towards that we helped pitch to the company and the staff. And we just started noticing a theme between them. So it came from the plays first, but seeing this connective tissue, and it made us sort of drive further in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
We won't be able to talk about every single play because you produce so much.
Right.
But we can talk about highlights. So you're starting out with One Man, Two Governors, which has had a wildly successful life in London and Broadway. And it's a retelling of Servant of Two Masters, right?
That is correct.
Interpretation, retelling is not quite right, right?
Well, a new interpretation. It was updated to the early 60s, the Broadway production, and our director, Rich Rand, who's one of our company members and is a professor at Purdue, went about three, 4 years forward, and we're actually setting it in Mod England in about 1967, which creates a lot of fun for costumes and scenery. And yes, absolutely. And we'll have live music that's then kind of updated to that era. So we think it's going to be a lot of fun. And you know, it jump-started James Corden's career, who went on to take over the post at the Late Late Show. He was such a physical comedian, and the show is incredibly physical, in meaning a lot of pratfalls, some stage combat, some dance, a lot of movement. And, of course, we've got some of the best physical actors in town, including Rob Johansson, Bill Simmons, and this wonderful new actor to us who's only – this will be his third production – Nathan Robbins, who was our Crippled Billy in The Cripple of Inishman and also was a highlight in American Idiot. He's since moved to New York, but he's come back. He made a commitment to do this show just at the time that he was moving to New York, so he's come back to do that starring role.
Fantastic. It sounds like a big sort of over-the-top, wildly colorful way to start the year.
It absolutely is. I think that there are 10 cast members, so it's a large cast. And like I said, live music, a lot of physical antics going on.
So we go from that to your second production, which takes place in an online world, right?
Well, this play, The Nether, comes from a strong young playwright, but Jennifer Haley, and she's very fascinated by technology and ethics and where those cross, and a lot of her work deals with that. And the play is set in a near future and feels very much early on like one of those cop interrogation scenes, but then unfolds to this virtual reality that's very lush, and surprises sort of abound from there. I don't want to give too much away.
Ooh, sounds kind of creepy and dark. I like it.
It's the total opposite of One Hundred Governors. And we do this interesting process of selecting plays. We kind of use our board, our artists, and some patrons at this wonderful event called Pitch Night, where we describe the things that we're thinking about. And I have to say that when we talked about this play, the audience had a big gasp.
Ooh.
It was like, oh, you could just feel them all taking this intake of air. And I love the play, but you remember years back we did The Pillow Man?
Yes.
It's going to put you a little bit in mind of that, only it's really set in the – a little bit more in the future and deals more with technology and, as Tom said, too, just morality and ethics and things that are happening online.
And I bet you go away without all the answers. I bet you go away after the evening with a lot of questions.
You're absolutely right. It poses an interesting statement that you wonder, you know, what's better, this world or that?
Cool. And now to a production that's actually in the process of being assembled. You have a call for entry out for sketches for A Very Phoenix Xmas X or 10.
Mm-hmm.
explain that format to us.
So this is my third year working on the show. So the show is older than I have been working on it. But we sent out a submission calling for essentially 7-minute plays, and they can be all sorts of things. They tend to be around a holiday, wintry theme. I read probably over 100 plays every year, try to sort some of the top ones that Brian and the staff and some of the actors start to read, and we narrow it down. We add on some other performative, some songs, some whatever skills the actors have, and create a show that has some sort of cohesive structure to it.
And there's a limit to the number of cast members, right? That you're
asking
for sketches for?
I actually increased it this year to, we average probably about 6, but last year we had 7, and then this year I just thought, you know, it's an anniversary, so I invited back some very specific past alumni of the show, and we have 8.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Or is the submission deadline passed? Or if somebody's hearing this and says, well, I've been actually working on a sketch that deals with winter holidays, can they send it to you?
They still can. In fact, the window is from September 1st to October 1st.
Fabulous.
And you can send it to my Phoenix email, which is thoran@phoenixtheater.org.
Fantastic. The New Year starts with a playwright you've produced before. This is Richard Strand is the playwright of 10% of Molly Snyder, right? Is that right?
you know, I have to double check because I hadn't put that together. But you were there. You're probably right.
So Butler, and it's a period piece, which people don't always associate with the Phoenix.
Yeah, very seldom does that happen. But, you know, it is set at the beginning of the Civil War. It's very, very topical at the time that we were reading it with all of the discussion about what was the Civil War really fought over. It's really the beginning of that discussion about Black Lives Matter. We felt that it was incredibly topical, even though it's set in a historic time. It's very funny, very informative. I mean, as always with our plays, I mean, I always learn new things, new facts about life and history. And the main character really helped craft the language that allowed the North to veer from the law that dictated that any runaway slaves had to be returned to the South.
Sharon Gamble with Phoenix, producing director Brian Fonseca, and playwright in residence Tom Horan. Learn more about their season of mysteries, including One Man, Two Governors, The Nether, and more at phoenixtheater.org. That's Phoenix Theater with an R-E at the end.org. And if you have a script for a very Phoenix Xmas to submit to Tom, then send it to thoran@phoenixtheater.org. thoran@phoenixtheater.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owls Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll hear about some jazz that's being performed in Speedway.
Fast jazz, right? I'll get a preview of the Hendrix Symphonic Society's new season.
And I'll find out what the Young Actors Theater is up to this fall. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.